Hello and welcome. This is South Jersey Pharmapod, the official podcast of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. I'm Steve Lubetkin of Lubetkin Communications. We produce business podcasts throughout New Jersey and Pennsylvania. This is episode 1 of South Jersey Pharmapod. The Alliance held its spring conference on May 2, 2006 at the Enterprise Center at Burlington County College in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. In this episode, we'll hear the first part of the morning presentations at the conference. These include the following. We had introductory and welcoming remarks from Don Seco, who's Executive Director of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. We'll then hear from the Honorable Bob Franks, former Congressman and President of the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey. We'll get an update on South Jersey's importance to New Jersey's overall economy from former Governor James Florio. And then we'll hear about the impact of the pharmaceutical industry on the New Jersey economy from Dr. Donald Sebastian, Senior Vice President for Research and Development at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Before we go to the speaker presentations, we wanted to spend a few minutes with Don Seco to talk about the Alliance and its role in the pharmaceutical industry. We are with Don Seco, who's the Executive Director of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. And we are, of course, creating our first podcast for the Alliance today. Don, welcome to the podcast, and tell us a little bit about how the organization got started.
Great, and I know that's a mouthful, but we wanted to make sure we captured the essence of what this Alliance is all about. And basically what it is, it's the pharmaceutical and medical technology industry's vendors in the southern part of the state, which make up the 8 southern counties. The industry figured out early on that it doesn't have a real facility presence in this part of the state, and it needed to be able to talk to legislators and other public policymakers about their issues. And so they asked us to organize their vendors, and we've grown to be more than 300 strong.
Today's program is an annual conference. Tell us a little about how that got started.
We asked our members what they were looking to hear, and what they really wanted to hear about was issues of importance to South Jersey and to the industry. And we put together our first conference last fall at Stockton College. We're going to try to move it around the southern part of the state, and we're in Mount Laurel today. And so we plan on doing actually twice a year we're going to have conferences, and we also plan on bringing folks up to Trenton and to one of the facilities up north. So we'll do 4 events a year. All of our events are free. Membership is free, and hope folks join.
What's the one message you want to get across to organizations, companies that might be interested in getting involved with your Alliance?
There's nothing to lose by joining the Alliance. It's free membership. It's free programs. The only thing we ask, like any Alliance, you know, you have to rely on the members of your Alliance for help. When we need you to help us, we hope you'll be there. But it's an excellent opportunity to network with folks who are also interested, if they're not already doing business with the pharmaceutical industry, but interested in doing business in the future. It's an excellent way to talk with them and to meet members of the pharmaceutical industry as well.
Don, thanks for being with us, and congratulations on the event today.
Thank you, Steve.
And now Don Seco is approaching the podium to introduce the presenters for this podcast.
Let me thank you all for coming. Let me briefly go through today's agenda and let you know about some changes to the agenda. We're going to be welcomed by the president of Burlington County College, Dr. Bob Messina. And then we're going to hear from the president of the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey, Bob Franks. Speaker Joe Roberts got called to Trenton for budget discussions, but he may try to stop by on his way to Trenton. Then we will hear from former Governor Jim Florio. Following that, we'll hear from Dr. Donald Sebastian from NJIT. We'll have a brief cell phone coffee break after that presentation, and then we'll have a panel, which we're calling How to Lobby, where we have some experienced and expert lobbyists who will give us the tools of the trade. After that, we're going to talk about podcasting and blogging, and I'm really looking forward to that, by Steve Lubetkin. Then we're going to break for lunch. You're going to have a choice for lunch. You can go over there to the next room and actually eat there, or you can bring your lunch back here and eat at these tables. Following lunch, we're going to have our legislative panel, which will include Senators Diane Allen and Martha Bark, and also Assemblyman Jack Connors. Dr. Conaway got called away and will not be with us for the panel, although he too said he might try to stop by in the morning, and if he does, we'll put him up here to say a few words. And then following that, we will have our drawing for door prizes, and you must be present to win. It's our way of keeping you here till the end of the program. This organization has grown to more than 300 members from a little breakfast that we had at Ponzio's about a year ago. The organization that does business or wants to do business with both the pharmaceutical and medical technology industry. We chose the word alliance carefully. We didn't use the word organization, association. We could have called ourselves a group, any number of words. We chose the word alliance because allies, I guess with the possible exception of France, help one another. And they're there for one another when you need them. And so hopefully this organization and the industry has been or will be there for you when you need them, and vice versa, when they need you, when there's some activity or some legislation or something that's going on in Trenton and Washington that they need your assistance on, hopefully you'll be willing to pick up the phone, do a fax, send an email. We make it easy for you. You can just go to a website, fill in your name, address, and your other information, and it will be sent for you. So when we call on you in the future and we need your help, hopefully you'll be there for us as well. 15 of the top 25 pharmaceutical companies and medical technology companies in the world are headquartered right here in New Jersey. This is a critical place for that industry. And, you know, there's a reason that they do business in New Jersey. There's a reason that they do business in America, because here you have both the economic and intellectual property rights freedom that you don't have maybe in Europe or in Japan, where some of these companies are originally from. And, you know, I know we all have our opinions about what happened yesterday and has been happening for the last couple of weeks around the country, but I will remark that you don't see a lot of rallies and protests in other parts of the world where people are begging and yelling, please let me stay here. This is a special place, and New Jersey is a special place in this special place. Let me introduce our first speaker, someone who will welcome us, someone who I know. Dr. Robert Messina, this coming January, if he makes it that long, will be celebrating his 20th year as the president of Burlington County College. Dr. Messina was born and educated in New York City. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry from the City College of New York, his Master of Arts degree in chemistry from Hunter College, and his doctorate in analytical chemistry from Fordham University. And I have to read this part. The topic of his doctoral dissertation was the location and concentration of heavy metals in the brain, liver, and kidney by atomic absorption spectroscopy. So, he's a bright man. Since he got his doctorate, our careers have actually mirrored one another, because Dr. Messina taught at Nassau Community College, and I went to Nassau Community College. Dr. Messina also taught at the State University of New York at Westbury and the State University of New York at Binghamton, and I used to drive by Westbury on my way to the Westbury Music Fair and Binghamton on my way to Oswego, where I went to college. And he also taught at the State University of New York at Farmingdale, and I grew up in Farmingdale and used to go camping behind the college. And both his mom and my mom lived in Farmingdale. Dr. Messina was a Carnegie Fellow at Woodrow Wilson School of International Studies and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Since becoming president of Burlington County College, Dr. Messina has raised the college's profile in the local community across the state of New Jersey and on the national level. Burlington County College has the lowest tuition of any county college in the state, and fully 30% of all Burlington County high school seniors go to Burlington County College, and that's a remarkable number and a tribute to the job that Dr. Messina has done. Dr. Messina has been the recipient of a number of awards way too many to list, but a real champion of this kind of education and a real champion of affordable higher education. Let me welcome Dr. Messina.
Good morning and welcome to our Enterprise Center. Very happy to host the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. One of our functions at a community college is to promote business and industry in our community. And Burlington County, for some folks who may not know the geography, is the largest county in the state of New Jersey, 893 square miles. We have two campuses, one here. It's our Mount Laurel campus. Our other campus is in Pemberton, which is about 12 miles east here. And then we have two centers, one in Wellingboro and one in Mount Holly, and we're looking maybe to put two more centers in. And one of the things for community college is access. And also we try to remember our mission is to make education affordable. Right now we're at $66 a credit. We are the lowest in the state. There is no reason why any resident cannot go to school here. We even have provisions that if they can't afford the $66, we will make sure that there's some scholarship money available for them. 60% of our students are below the median income, and we provide that. And we're targeting 40%. Some of the high schools that come to us are as high as 60% of the graduating class. We don't inflate our numbers by saying those that go into college. If I did that, my number would be a lot higher. So we try to provide lots of things. One of the things that you may be interested in is the type of education that we do here is a lot of it's high tech on this campus. We have we're presently putting a nanotechnology program here. We have a nursing program that's one of the highest rated in the nation. Our NCLEX scores are usually a 95, 100%. Our radiography program is also one of the best or the highest pass rates. We're also expanding that to sonography and also going to do some other education for CAT scans and other PET scans. We just put a new dental hygiene program in. I think we rival UDMNJ, although that's probably not a good thing to say these days. Health information technology and biotechnology major. So we have a lot of interest in that. Get a chance, you can walk on the other adjoining building here. When we built this center, this is for business and industry. No college classes are taught in here. On the other side of that rotunda is all our science classes. The first floor are the general bio and general chem labs, and the second floor are the advanced biology labs, would be microbiology, biotech, and we have some brand new state-of-the-art equipment. I'm sure people would be happy to show you that. We also do a lot of customized training. We have over 8,000 credit, and we have another 8,000 non-credit. We do that for frontline training for a lot of the businesses and industry, computer training, customer service, specialized training for those in the medical field. We just formed a new partnership with Drexel University. We're having 17 programs start in September. Those will be in the areas of chemical, civil, mechanical, computer engineering. All will be taught here on campus. Students will get their degree from Drexel University. And we'll add another 8 programs the next year. And they will be, and we also having biosciences, biomedical engineering, and probably some graduate programs coming in a little bit later. We're doing them in partnership with Lockheed Martin. Also, for your information, we're the first community college in the country to receive funding from the CDC to be a CPHP. That's the Center for Public Health Preparedness, along with the after 9/11, the CDC established around the country centers that could do plans and do training for people in the medical field in crisis situations. And we were the only community college who had the audacity to challenge medical schools and the schools of public health and say we could do the job as good or better than you could. And we received $900,000 in funding, and the CDC has asked us to reapply for funding because of the little bit of money that they gave us, and that's little compared to some of the medical schools. We have built a CDC lab that has the largest human patient simulators in the nation. We have 14 of them, And these are human patients, some very sophisticated that you could apply any type of projected illness to, anthrax included, and look at the simulations, the reactions, and they can test students, which are nursing students. They can test technologists, and it can test, we even challenged MDs, anesthesiologists, and they said this was so easy, a child could do it. Well, guess what? Well, they had 30 minutes to detect a problem, and all of them failed it. So they got a little more respect for simulation and simulation training. A lot of it is game theory technology that we're doing with a lot of the hospitals. And then also we're very proud of, we're building in addition to our science incubator. Our science incubator was started by Frank Keith, and we're very appreciative of that. And we're adding an addition now. It's a life sciences incubator, and there will be all labs for biotech and pharmaceuticals. So if you're interested in that, let us know. We are happy to have you here this morning. I know you have a lot of important business to discuss, so I will not delay you any further. Well, welcome to the college, and I hope you get a chance to tour it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. It makes me happy when I look around the room and see people sitting in chairs along the wall or standing. That means we have a good crowd. But if you want, the tables aren't all that crowded. You can pull your chairs up to a table if you'd be more comfortable, or you can stay where you are. Our next speaker is Bob Franks. I call him Congressman. Bob Franks is the president of the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey, based in Hillside. Bob Franks was appointed as only the second chief executive of the Institute in August of 2001. Established in 1997, the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey is an association of 25 research-based pharmaceutical and medical technology companies in New Jersey. Congressman Franks has enjoyed a long and distinguished career in public service. It's hard to believe looking at how young he looks here. But he has been a leader in New Jersey politics and government for three decades. Prior to joining the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey, Congressman Franks served four consecutive terms as a congressman from New Jersey's 7th District, which covers parts of Union, Somerset, Middlesex, and Essex counties. Congressman Franks completed his fourth term in January 2001. During his tenure in Congress, Congressman Franks served on the Budget Committee as well as the Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. In the 106th Congress, the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee reorganized, and Mr. Franks became chairman of the new Economic Development, Public Buildings, Hazardous Materials, and Pipeline Transportation Subcommittee. He was co-chairman of the Northeast Midwest Congressional Coalition and founded the Congressional Task Force on Manufacturing. He also was a founder and co-chairman of the Missing and Exploited Children's Caucus and sponsored numerous bills aimed at protecting children. Before serving in Congress, Congressman Franks was a member of the New Jersey General Assembly for 13 years. I'm proud to say that I was able to work for him, representing the 22nd District, which covered Union and Somerset counties. Congressman Franks also served as the New Jersey Republican State Chairman from 1987 to 1989, and then again from 1990 to 1992, when he stepped down to run for Congress. Congressman Franks was a key advisor to Governor Tom Kaine in his 1981 gubernatorial election, and he went on to manage the campaigns of New Jersey Congressman Jim Corder and Dean Gallo. Congressman Franks has a bachelor's degree from DePaul University and a JD from Southern Methodist University. He resides in Warren with his wife, Fran, and he's a member of the Three Daughter Club. He has three, as I am, he has three daughters, Kelly, Sarah, and Abigail. Congressman Franks.
Thank you. First off, thanks to Don Seco and Joy Seco for helping to put together today's program. Thanks to Bob Messina and all his colleagues here at Burlington County. And for all of you who chose to take time out of your own very busy schedules to be with us today, I am honored, truly, to know that in the audience is Governor Jim Florio. Governor Florio has been the principal champion of South Jersey for as long as I've been involved in the public life of our state, and for him as a governor who is still in great demand across the state in a whole variety of capacities, for him to come and spend a few minutes with us today. Governor, thank you so very much. We're grateful to have you. Let me remind all of you what kind of brought us together here a year ago. We in New Jersey recognize that we are a center of the pharmaceutical and medical technology marketplace. In fact, among those 25 companies that Don mentioned that are members of the Healthcare Institute of New Jersey, those companies are responsible for the manufacturing and sale of over 50% of the world's medicines, a remarkable volume of medicine distributed in every corner of the planet to help improve the condition of human health. Of those 25 companies that are members of the Healthcare Institute, 9 of them make their global headquarters here in the state of New Jersey. Another 6 of those companies make their North American headquarters here in New Jersey. But the reality is that most of those physical plants, most of those facilities are based north of the Raritan River. So if you live in South Jersey, you likely don't have a next-door neighbor who commutes every day to one of the 102 facilities that belong to the companies that are members of the Healthcare Institute. If you live in Central or North Jersey, it's likely, honestly, that someone, at least in your neighborhood, probably does. Why do I say that? Because as of this year, there are 60,170 men and women reporting this morning to one of those 102 facilities that belong to one of our 25 member companies. But this is largely an industry that in public's perception is a North Jersey or Central Jersey industry. And candidly, we are challenged often as we are the advocates on behalf of this high technology sector of New Jersey's economy, the sector that most say drives our continuing economic success and holds the greatest potential for economic growth, trying to find ways to interface with the community of South Jersey better than the ways that we have in the past. So we asked our 25 companies, we know you're up in North Jersey, but do you ever do business with anybody in South Jersey? And they said, well, how would you like us to find out? And I gave them the list of every single zip code in the 8 counties of South Jersey, and I said, can you run this against your vendor profile? And what we got was kind of interesting. 2,700 matches. 2,700 entities with whom those 25 companies do business in the 8 counties of South Jersey. I asked the companies, what was the dollar value of those contracts last year? It's about $510 million. So we're not here, but we're sort of here. We make investments here with companies large and in some cases very small to provide the products and the services that these companies need in order to thrive. We need to make New Jerseyans across the state aware that this is a statewide asset. And it provides a wonderful opportunity for both direct employment and indirect employment. And that's one of the reasons why we decided to contact some of the people who want to do business with the pharmaceutical and medical technology industry, or currently do it, or have done it in the past and would like to do more of it, to come together in this group. And Don has done a great job in helping to shepherd this organization over the course of the last year. And I'm grateful for that. I'm coming to give you 2 pieces of news. One is to give you an update on a program that we feel very strongly about. It's called RX for New Jersey. And that is a program that recognizes that there are some people in our state, too many people, in fact, who urgently need but cannot afford the life-saving, life-enhancing medicines that are made by our member companies. We sought about to create a program that was designed to find who those people are, let them know that there are programs through which they can acquire free medicine, and to get those medicines to the people who need them. We launched this program about 16 months ago. And since that day, January the 4th, 2005, 158,000 New Jerseyans have telephoned our 1-800 toll-free number or logged on to our website. Of that 158,000, 120,000 have been matched to one or more patient assistance programs. 120,000 New Jerseyans who needed medicines and couldn't afford it have been provided those medicines free of charge. So if there are friends, neighbors, relatives, anyone in your community who you know still needs access to those medicines, have them contact RX for New Jersey, because this is a continuing mission. We feel very strongly about it, and we're gratified by the success that we've had, but we know that we have not yet reached every individual who needs that medicine and cannot afford it. So we are open to all of you, please helping us to spread the word about the availability of this important program. The other update I want to give you is our construction forecast. Every year, the New Jersey Alliance for Action asks different industrial sectors what their plans are in the upcoming year by way of capital construction. And obviously, one of the groups that they survey is the state's pharmaceutical and medical technology industry. Well, I am proud to tell you that for the fifth consecutive year, the pharmaceutical and medical technology industry leads all private sector industry groups in the amount of investment that they intend to make over the course of the next year. It's a two-year forecast that the Alliance asked for. Let me give you the numbers. In 2006, as we surveyed our 25 companies, they project doing $1.95 billion in calendar year 2006 in capital construction activities. In 2007, they anticipated making expenditures totaling $2.3 billion. Folks, that's a lot of capital improvement. It comes both in the form of building new state-of-the-art facilities, and it comes in rehabilitating, refurbishing older facilities that are in constant need of attention in order to stay world-class and state-of-the-art. These companies come to New Jersey and remain in New Jersey for one overriding reason, and that is the exceptionally skilled workforce that we have here in our state. More scientists per square mile than any state in America. And that has led to there being more pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey than any state in America. And interestingly, more pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey than any foreign country anywhere in the planet. That is the scope of concentration that we enjoy today from these life sciences companies. This capital construction activity is going to mean opportunities for those who need to help them construct these facilities, build out these facilities, supply these facilities, and provide the services that these facilities will need. These world-class scientists who are at work this morning looking for cures to diseases like Alzheimer's and cancer, diabetes, and a list of 80 different disease states that our researchers here in New Jersey are working on today. They stay here because of the quality of life in New Jersey, and they stay with these companies because these companies are leading the world in medical discoveries. And to do that, they need the world's best facilities. And maybe some of you can anticipate a way where you can fit into some of those opportunities. It's great to come back and talk to all of you today. You have a number of other very good speakers to follow, and I again want to express my appreciation to both Don and Joyce Seco and to all of you who've chosen to come today. Thank you very much.
I'm very proud of our next speaker. Our next speaker is the former governor of the state of New Jersey, Jim Florio. Governor Florio is a founding partner of the law firm of Florio, Perucci, Steinhardt, and Fader, based in Phillipsburg, New Jersey. He's a university professor for public policy and administration at the Blaustein Graduate School of Public Policy at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. Governor Florio also served as chairman of the board of directors of the Federal Home Loan Bank in New York and as chairman of the Pinelands Commission in New Jersey. He currently serves on the board of directors of the New Jersey Healthcare Quality Institute and Trump Entertainment Resorts. Governor Florio served as governor of the state of New Jersey from 1990 through 1994. As governor, he was responsible for signing into law the Clean Water Enforcement Act, one of the strongest environmental laws of its type in the nation. He also signed the Quality Education Act, which provided greater equity in New Jersey's school finance system, a landmark welfare reform package, a health care cost reduction program, and the nation's toughest assault weapons ban. While in Congress from 1974 through 1990, representing the 1st District of New Jersey in the United States House of Representatives, Governor Florio authored the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, otherwise known as Superfund. It's our nation's primary program for cleaning up hazardous waste sites. As chairman of the House subcommittee with jurisdiction over environmental matters, he was involved in the drafting or passage of virtually every major piece of federal environmental legislation. Governor Florio also wrote the legislation which privatized Conrail and served on the U.S. Secretary of Energy's advisory board. Governor Florio entered public service in 1969, serving 3 terms in the New Jersey General Assembly. Prior to that, he was an attorney in private practice in Camden County. Governor Florio received his Juris Doctor from Rutgers University Law School in Camden in 1967, and he graduated magna cum laude from Trenton State College and attended graduate school at Columbia University, where he received a prestigious Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. A veteran of the United States Navy, Governor Florio served 4 years of active duty and 18 years in active naval reserve, retiring with the rank of lieutenant commander in 1975. Governor Florio holds numerous honorary degrees and was the 1993 recipient of the Profile in Courage Award by the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, a man who I'm proud to call friend, Governor Florio.
Thank you very much, and good morning to everyone. It's a very impressive crowd, and I want to thank Don and Joyce for the invitation to come and be part of the program. I was just thinking, as Don was giving that nice introduction, that when you've been around a very long period of time, the introductions start to sound like obituaries. And then the nice welcome is appreciated as well. And I think Bob Franks can appreciate my observation that after you've been out of office for a very, very long time, and you no longer have a position of any sort and constitute no threat to anyone, everyone loves you. And my response is, where were you all before? But I appreciate the opportunity to come and to share with you some thoughts about the southern part of the state. I guess I have to confess that I'm not originally from South Jersey. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I'll give you the two-minute history of how I got here and how I have been a South Jersey resident at heart, even though now I live in Metuchen, New Jersey. I still have my grandchildren down here, so it gives me an emotional continuing connection to South Jersey. As I said, I was born in Brooklyn, and I joined the Navy, as Don observed, when I was 17. And while I was in the service, my father, who worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, closed. So he started working out of the shipyards in Hoboken and Bayonne and Jersey City. And so when I came out of the service, I was a New Jersey resident. And then ultimately gravitated here to go to law school. I came here at the age of, I guess, about 24, 25, with 2 children and a pregnant wife and no job prospects to go to law school at Rutgers in Camden. And couldn't afford it at first, so I worked for a year at the Glassboro Housing Authority. And then I went to Rutgers Law School, and I worked my way through school as a night watchman at Woodrow Wilson High School. And then when I passed the bar exam, I ran for office for the legislature. And you heard Don give you the rest, 6 years in the legislature, and then 16 years in the Congress, and then 4 years as governor, and then an involuntary retirement. And my friends then said I had to really go to work for a change. And I've been doing a whole bunch of things that Don outlined earlier on. And I'm now working in around the state in a couple of different capacities, staying closely connected with the South Jersey economy, which in one respect is what I wanted to talk to you about, because Don assigned me the task of talking about, in a sense, South Jersey's evolution over the last number of years. And one of the virtues of longevity, maybe even one of the few virtues of longevity, is you have a sense of proportion. You have a sense of perspective, and you can see how things evolve over a period of time. And my history in this area is literally almost 30, going on 40 years of seeing how things have changed in the southern portion of the state. I look in the audience, and I suspect there are probably a couple of people who can remember this, but in the end of the 70s, I mean, there was a semi-serious proposal to have South Jersey secede from the state. I see nodding of heads, so you can recall that there really was some discussion about it. And in some respects, that sort of was a reflection of the inferiority complex that folks in New Jersey had about how they were treated, in some respects justifiable, that the southern portion of the state was really not paid attention to, as some of us down here thought it should be, particularly out of Trenton. And there were probably some reasons for it. One was population. The population was clearly dominant in the northern portion of the central and northern portion of the state. There were all the other concerns as well. Politically, I can remember when I went to the legislature in 1969, the urban-oriented delegations from Passaic County, Essex County, Hudson County, and Middlesex County dominated the legislature. When they were together, everything else was just sort of routine. They would make determinations about what policies were going to be, and the numbers were sufficient so that that was how things were dealt with. The economic clout of the southern portion of the state was nowhere near what it is today. There really wasn't a lot happening, hence economics didn't weigh in on behalf of the interests of this portion of the state. And we were very, sort of the people in the South were chomping at the bit as to why we were always left out of allocations of money. Money would come to the state from Washington, and we would have the perception that it never came south, it always went north. I'll share with you a story that I think Bob Franksman can remember, which tells you a little bit about how there was this sense of us against them. It was the 1981 gubernatorial campaign. I ran against Tom Kaine, lost by a fairly small margin. But one of the things that highlighted to me, and I'm not particularly proud of this little event, we had a debate down at then Glassboro State College. And Governor Kaine, and we all know Governor Kaine has this manner about him that is sort of almost British, and he coming in and has this very nice stentorian voice and whatever. And he came down, and as we all do in politics, try to play a little bit to the audience. And so he came down and he said, I'm happy to be here down in Glassboro. I came down and I drove down Denby Drive and whatever, whatever, whatever. I, in a purely pandering way, corrected him nicely but pointedly by saying, I'm sure he drove down Delcy Drive, and all the audience went crazy about, oh boy, he knows where he is. This other guy from North Jersey doesn't know where he is. And it was not my highest level of debate. But, you know, when you're being demagogic, do it. Do it. But it was a reflection of that sense of us against them. Well, I guess what I would share with you now is that things have changed over this period of time dramatically, and that the southern portion of the state has come into its own in ways that are, in some respects, very, very powerful. The most glaring example, in my mind, is politically. That if you go into the legislature now, you will find, and Joe Roberts, who used to work for me as a student intern, and as someone who was a wonderful, wonderful representative for me when I was in Congress, is now the Speaker of the General Assembly.
Yeah. Lou Greenwald is the chairman of the Budget Committee. Wayne Bryant's the Appropriations. I mean, you go down the whole list. You're going to be having some legislators here this afternoon, I understand, who are all very powerful forces in the state legislature. And however it's come to pass, the southern portion of the state is thoroughly represented in the state legislature, which is a very significant change from the way that it once was. Population-wise, I mean, we have some of the fastest-growing areas in the state in the southern portion of the state, Burlington County. You go down to southern Gloucester County and little towns like Swedesboro, Warwick Township, and places of that sort are among the fastest-growing areas in the state of New Jersey. So that is starting to make a turn for the better as far as the fortunes of the state. Probably in terms of the economy and economic developments, some of the most dramatic and dynamic events that are occurring in New Jersey are occurring down here. I put a couple of notes here. Atlantic City, with the Borgata coming, you have a whole new mentality in Atlantic City, not designed going forward exclusively for day trippers, trying to build the sort of a Las Vegas mentality that you should go to Atlantic City and stay for a more elongated period of time. Towers are being built. The mention was made about the Trump board that I serve on. Trump is building another tower adjacent to the Taj Mahal. Some of the other casinos are building more extensive facilities. The benefits will be more people coming here. The clear, quick benefits are the construction trades who will be doing some building. We have in Atlantic City wind turbines. I mean, sort of the next generation of alternative energy systems being built there now on a demonstration project. And I suspect we'll be talking about wind turbines off the coast as the new technology that becomes more or less intrusive starts to evolve. We're talking about a whole lot of other things, new housing for employees at the northern end of the city and at the southern end of the city. That'll be much more affordable housing so as to be able to house the workers in the casinos and the related industries. There are sites for ethanol plants that are being talked about in South Jersey. Ethanol being a very important part of our ability to formulate a new energy policy for the nation. Ethanol being something that our South Jersey farmers will be able to benefit from as well. There are new technologies that are being put forward. My understanding is that Governor Corzine is very supportive of trying to engage all the state resources to make sure that we are going to be at the center of that whole new part of the energy industry. Ethanol comes from, for the most part, the Midwest. There's a facility in Ottawa. But if, in fact, we're going to be having this as part of our energy policy, we should have something in this region of the nation so as to maximize the benefit of that new type of technology. An LNG plant, liquefied natural gas, is currently being planned down in the Logan Township area in Gloucester County. We're talking about the southern portion of Gloucester County, as I said, growing rapidly to the point where there are now plans for sewage capacity expansions in that area. If that happens, that will reinforce the development of greater growth in that part of New Jersey. And I think it's fair to say that Cumberland County, Salem County, the southern part of Gloucester County have not been growing in the past in the way that we would like them to grow. And therefore, to the degree we start making the infrastructure improvements for that part of the state, we will have growth. And that I'm convinced the political leadership will ensure that we have sustainable growth, growth that's compatible with the infrastructure needed to make sure that that growth is not inappropriate and somehow burdensome. The South Jersey Port Corporation is doing a lot of very important things, responding to the global trade arena that we find ourselves in. The whole port initiative in Paulsboro is a very exciting proposal that is going to take place. Everyone has signed off on it, so it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when that initiative takes place. Camden, place where I live for many years, has had $175 million in infrastructure money placed at the disposal of the city and the agencies that are going to be working with it. And I happen to believe very strongly we've had a lot of false starts over the last 30 or 40 years. This one is real. It's going to take a bit of time, but I don't have any doubts whatsoever that Camden, as with most of our urban areas, are about to be revitalized. If for no other reason, because of the market forces that are taking so much land in New Jersey out of circulation. If you think about it, the Pinelands is 20% of New Jersey, the Highlands is 15% of New Jersey, 35% of the state is off the table as far as unfettered economic development. Therefore, with fixed capital costs, developers will have to go back into the urban areas. To the degree that policymakers assist that process with investments and smart governance, and smart governance, it will happen sooner than later, and it will happen in a benign, quite helpful way for all of us to benefit from. I guess I would just finalize my remarks at this point by saying that I'm extremely optimistic that all the forces that are at work will ensure that the southern part of the state is going to take its rightful place as part and a very important part of the overall health of the state that we are in. Don gave me a time assignment, and I'm a couple of minutes ahead of my time assignment, so I'm going to just take a moment to gratuitously reinforce my reputation as a policy wonk by just sharing with you a couple of thoughts on one of the things that you're all here to talk about, which is healthcare. And I know that you've got a lobbying session happening today, and you've got legislators happening today. Reference was made in the introduction to my teaching at the Blaustein School. And one of the things my students this semester and I did was to sort of identify a couple of policy areas that are going to be priority areas that are in a state of flux to the degree that there's going to need to be some basic, fundamental, systemic changes in those sectors. And two of the ones that are interesting, one is energy policy. And I think we all know when we go out and drive that something is going to have to be done to change the nature of our policy, which is fundamentally based on the availability of overseas sources of hydrocarbons. Well, the other area that we've focused on has been healthcare and how the healthcare industry is going to be changing over the next number of years so as to be able to take into account some of the difficulties we have in healthcare policy. And of course, the pharmaceutical industry and the medical devices industry are very significant and important parts of the healthcare industry. And I guess our observation is that to the degree that we have a healthcare system that is fundamentally employee-based, employment-based healthcare, that is to say that most people get their health insurance from their employment. And to the degree that we're in a global economy and we're competing in our businesses and in our providing of products and services with people around the world who don't factor the cost of healthcare into the cost of their products, we are at a competitive disadvantage. And so you're starting to see more and more manufacturers and companies say, well, we have to at least think about an alternative way of providing healthcare rather than rolling the cost of healthcare into the cost of my automobile or into the cost of my service. So that's something that's very important that people in healthcare are going to have to think about. I think it's fair to say that beyond question, we have a quality of healthcare that is the envy of the rest of the world. And the pharmaceutical industry is a very important part of seeking after that high quality. One of the things that is the essence of trying to come to good healthcare policies is to try to bring some degree of equilibrium to healthcare, balancing three variables. One is quality, which we clearly have. Another is affordability, which we may very well be starting to lose for a lot of people. And the other is access to the system. And in that area, we've been a total failure. I mean, there are 45 million Americans who have no access to health insurance at all. I mean, these are folks that are not poor enough to be able to get Medicaid. They're not old enough to be able to get Medicare. They don't happen to work for somebody that provides them health insurance, and they can't afford out of their own pocket to buy private health insurance. I mean, and most of these folks, by the way, are either children or they are working. These are the working poor folks. So it's not like they're slackers or malingerers. These are folks who are just stuck as a result of the policy we have of not providing health insurance to all of our citizens, as most people do in the rest of the industrialized world. So I throw this all out to you just to say that these are going to be challenging times for all of us, obviously the healthcare industry, but all of us as citizens, to be able to think through how we go to the next step. There are clearly lots and lots of models, but I think it's essential. It's essential in terms of health. I mean, we should not be proud of the fact that in certain indexes, infant mortality, I mean, there are places in this country that have infant mortality rates that are worse than third world nations. That's not something that should be a source of pride to any of us. And then in terms of our economy, the cost of healthcare, as I suspect probably employers in the audience can tell you, is getting to be something that is becoming oppressive to folks. And again, we have to pierce through the thin veneer of statistical indicators. For example, we're starting to see the cost of healthcare come down for employers this year. But guess what? Why it's coming down for employers is it's being offloaded over to employees in terms of co-pays and deductibles and things of that sort. So that's not a particularly good outcome. So I would just conclude by saying that this is an important initiative. I think this is, and Don and all the rest of the people who are responsible for the program are clearly on the right track in saying that all of us are connected to all of us. And so to the degree that the industry is reaching out to those that they interact with, who may not think of themselves as sort of on the front of dealing with healthcare, the answer is you are. And in the same way, the healthcare industry may not think of itself as a vital importance to the rest of our society that are not connected to healthcare, but they are. So I guess the conclusion that I would leave you with is that democracy is not a spectator sport. And so it's time for everyone sort of to get off the bench and into the game. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Governor. We have time. I don't know what this does to Steve, who's actually recording this for a podcast, but we have time for a couple of questions. If you'd please just raise your hand, I'll call on you, just say your name and your firm, and then ask your question. Anybody have any questions?
Terry Wall, DG Wall Management Consulting. You approved, Governor Borio, that of that 45 million that you mentioned that are uninsured, at least from what I've read, at least a third of them are people who choose not to be insured for whatever reason. They don't think they're going to get sick or they don't want to spend the money. And another large segment, almost a third, are people who haven't been told or shown how they get into the system.
No, I don't think that's correct. The percentage of the people who choose not to be insured generally are young people, very, very young people, who think that they're going to live forever and they never have any problems. In fact, when they do, as with the rest of the population that is uninsured, all too frequently what they do is they resort to showing up at the emergency rooms in hospitals where they're required to get care, which they do, and our hospitals are good about providing them. But the hospitals, of course, then have to eat the costs. And when they eat the costs, they really don't eat the costs. They either get reimbursed from the state through taxpayers' monies, or more probably what they do is they just cross-subsidize so that the folks who have health insurance have built into their premiums the cost that the hospitals pay for uncompensated care. And say, well, about the third number you're talking about, the third number is roughly children. I mean, those are the children of the uninsured. But most of the folks are working people. But as you can appreciate, if you're out there working on a full-time job, and let's say you're making $20,000 a year, the expectation, and you don't have health insurance at your job, the expectation that you're going to be able to afford $5,000 or $6,000 for a family health insurance plan purchased privately is sort of unrealistic. And I think we're all coming to the realization that that's not something that we can tolerate. And politically, and again, nobody wants to even talk about this, but if we have a dramatic recession at some point in our future, which I suspect we will, and middle-class people start getting laid off and thereby losing their health insurance, guess what? In this nation, we listen to middle-class people when they become unhappy. If that comes to pass, folks are going to be talking particularly to Washington, you know, saying, what are you going to do about this? So if we're talking about $45 million to start, and we ever experience a serious downturn, and that number goes up easily to 40, 50, or 50, 60 million people, and they become articulate people who do take part in the process, then you will see demands. My only observation about that is it's in those periods of time when we sometimes do the worst things, because we do it rapidly, we do it without a whole lot of thought, we would be well advised to start thinking in advance about what it is we want to do to have a cost-effective system that does bring into balance, you know, quality, affordability, and access. That should not be a very difficult problem if we apply ourselves to thinking about how it is done, but it's not going to be done thoughtfully if we do it in an emergency situation. Yes, sir.
Brent Bergen from U.S. Trust. There are no easy solutions to the healthcare problem. In addition to the uninsured and the challenges that poses, can you address the Medicare situation itself? Because there really seems to be an issue as to whether or not that system as it exists is going to be adequately funded in the future. There are many, depending on how you run the numbers, at some point, 2016 or 2020, that system will be bankrupt. So are you looking at a comprehensive reform that encompasses both covering the uninsured as well as reforming Medicare, or do you treat those as different challenges?
Well, I don't want to go off into too much politics in terms of where money's come from and whatever. That would be inappropriate, and I want to maintain my good relationship with Bob Franks. So, but I guess my thought is, and again, I will give you one scenario, and it's not necessarily the one I would advocate, but it is something that will get us to a point of universality, which ought to be the goal. And by the way, when we talk about universal health care, I don't think anybody who is even semi-serious is talking about some sort of a socialized medicine system where all the doctors are employees of the government. Nobody talks about that in our system. I think what people have talked about, responsible people have talked about, is having maybe multiple systems. The net result is that everyone is covered one way or the other with some threshold below which no one sinks. Talking about system. And one scenario has been, well, expanding Medicaid for poor people upward. Now, we've done some things like that. There's a program called CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, which starts to expand the coverage area for children. Then you can start talking about expanding Medicare, going down to 55 was a serious proposal at one point that was considered, so as to be able to cover those people. Have a couple of other programs so that at some point, a private insurance system for those who can afford it and want to have it, so that at some point, everybody is covered. This argument that's raised on behalf of that approach is, guess what? That will end up saving money when we take into account that all dollars are fungible. We're inclined to think about tax dollars for health in one area and private dollars for health in a different area. We have the highest percentage of our gross domestic product for health care than any nation on a per capita basis in the world. There are companies, Massachusetts, as you probably know, is experimenting with a system to require coverage for everyone. I would think that probably big employers in Massachusetts are probably going to benefit in terms of putting out less money for health care under a system whereby you either pay for health care for your employees or you kick into a fund that is used to provide health care coverage for people. So there's a high degree of creativity out there, and I would just suggest that there are certain basic principles that have to be undertaken if we're going to have a quality health care system that we as Americans can be proud of. The key issue, and this is the part that's going to be a little tough, is engaging in a broad philosophic debate about what is health care. Is health care a commodity such that the marketplace forces can work on it, and if you can afford it, you can have it? I mean, almost like a television. If you can afford it, you can have it, or like a car. If I can afford a Cadillac, I can have the Cadillac. If I can afford a Volkswagen, I have a Volkswagen. Is that what we want healthcare to be? Or is healthcare to be an entitlement? Is healthcare to be sort of a characteristic that goes with citizenship? Sort of like police protection or fire protection. Most industrialized nations in the world go with the latter, saying that everybody as a citizen is entitled to some minimum degree of health care, and that is an approach that we're going to have to take in their minds. So we're going to have that debate. When we have the debate, and if in fact we start to come to the conclusion that it should not be essentially employment-based, it should not be treated as a commodity, then it's a matter of fitting a system that is uniquely American, in terms of not monolithic, not clinics for everybody, but taking into account our idea of wanting to have variations of a system, as long as there is this flaw, as long as there is this threshold below which no one goes. I mean, just in terms of cost effectiveness, the idea of having, you know, an expectant mother have access to prenatal care ought to be something that every American family is entitled to. Not only because it's a nice thing, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because failure to have that prenatal care results in a disproportionate number of low birth weight babies being born, which end up being much more costly for the society, to say nothing of the inhumaneness of avoiding those problems if we can avoid them. And I would suggest to you that we can.
Good time for one last question.
Yes.
Hi, Ron Lynch with North Star Business Consulting. Given the level of advocacy of the large-scale projects that are out there, I don't think anyone here really disagrees with you about the need for health care, but in your policy discussions, where are the trade-offs? Because there's a finite amount of money that's out there for the various programs that are there. Where do we trade this off?
Well, again, without getting into contemporary tax policy and where monies are currently going in Washington as opposed to where they could go, I would say that this is a sort of a win-win thing. And the consensus that's evolved is that our system, particularly the distribution aspects of our system, paying more money than anybody else in the world pays for health care, having a larger percentage of our citizens without any health care, evaluating the positions of all of the stakeholders in healthcare, all of whom are dissatisfied. Doctors, healthcare professionals aren't getting enough if one listens to them. Insurance companies are charging too much if we listen to everybody else. Government is paying too much. Citizens don't feel like they're getting the quality of care for the amount of money they're required to pay. This is a system that cries out for some degree of reform. And there is a consensus that, in fact, the system is not functioning well. Where the consensus breaks down, of course, is how it is you're going to correct it. Because it was interesting. I'll just share with you this one observation. And I remember this because I was a little bit involved as governor, listening to President Clinton when he came to New Jersey, lamenting his health care plans crashing and burning. And he demonstrated to me, and I saw some polls ultimately, that when people were polled about what they thought about healthcare in general, and asked whether they supported universal care. They said yes. Whether they supported standard benefit packages, yes. Whether they supported more technology, whether they supported more leveraging of people so as to be able to extract discounts from healthcare providers, they said yes. They said yes to all these things. Then they were asked, did they support the Clinton healthcare program? Overwhelmingly, no. All of the components that they supported were all the components in the healthcare plan. So it was really a very interesting exercise in the power of marketing for or against something. But I think these are things that we're going to come to some conclusions. We almost have no choice. And I suspect, as I said, employers in the audience and employers certainly out there know that the current policies are unsustainable. You're not going to be able to have, with the flow of capital and businesses being required to manage themselves with an idea of attracting the capital markets to your business, there's not a whole lot of pricing freedom out there so as to be able to lift prices. The competition that is around the world, you have no real great pricing freedom. So to maintain your profit margins so as to be able to attract capital, you have to go to the cost side. Yeah. And therefore, you've got to make some selections about very unattractive options. You sort of lay off people. You hire temps. You go to pension systems, and you get rid of your defined benefit system for a defined contribution system, which always doesn't go over well. Or you go to healthcare. And healthcare is going to be a prime area for people to look to reduce their costs on. That results in all kinds of disruption. So I'm just throwing out the idea that, guess what? We're all going to be engaged in this discussion. We're all being engaged in this. Start thinking about it now so you can have appropriate input. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Governor Florio certainly doesn't lack passion. I was sitting thinking, what I didn't tell you is that Governor Florio's daughter is a physician and his son-in-law is a physician, and I was curious as to the holiday dinner table discussions and how they might go. And, of course, he didn't talk about his real passion, which is gardening. Our next speaker is Dr. Donald Sebastian, who is the Senior Vice President for Research and Development at New Jersey Institute of Technology and president of the NJIT Research Corporation. He is responsible for the academic research enterprise as well as for developing partnerships with industry and for managing government affairs, intellectual property development, business incubation, commercialization, and contract projects across the technology spectrum. Under his leadership, the university's sponsored research has grown by nearly 50% in 4 years. The total research enterprise is now over $78 million, placing NJIT in the top 10 universities of engineering and science in the entire nation. Dr. Sebastian developed the program leading to NJIT's designation by the governor's executive order in June 2004 as the New Jersey Homeland Security Technology Systems Center. Dr. Sebastian has been the institutional lead in a state program to develop child-safe weapons technology that has drawn international media coverage and attracted over $4 million in state and federal support to develop the first biometric-based safety system for handguns. And he told me recently that we're on the verge of some significant breakthroughs in that area. Dr. Sebastian is the academic lead working with the New Jersey Stem Cell Research and Education Foundation. Dr. Sebastian joined NJIT as a professor in the Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Engineering in 1995. Prior to joining NJIT, Professor Sebastian was a member of the Chemical Engineering Faculty at Stevens Institute of Technology. Dr. Sebastian received his Bachelor of Engineering at Stevens, graduating as valedictorian in the class of 1974, followed by Master's of Engineering in 1975 and PhD in Chemical Engineering in 1977. He resides in Randolph, New Jersey with his wife Catherine and daughters Caitlin and Diana and son Christopher. Dr. Donald Sebastian.
Thank you all, and thank you, Don. Most importantly, thank you for editing down that introduction. There would have been no time left to talk.
Well, this is a very unenviable position. Following two professional orators who also know their stuff, that's a dangerous combination. I feel a little bit like a little leaguer asked to stand up to a Randy Johnson slider, but I need to rely on you then and play to your sympathies somehow. And I wish I could play the South Jersey card. As you heard, I'm a carpetbagger. I came from Connecticut, landed in North Jersey 36 years ago, haven't found a way to get out yet, and perhaps I never will. And so I speak the wrong language. I already told you, I root for the wrong team. I call it a Sudbury hero, not a hoagie. Ben Franklin is a Revolutionary War hero, and George Washington is a bridge. So I've got it all backwards. But in fact, my wife grew up in Cinnaminson, about 2 miles directly that way. Her mother's still there. Her sister and her family are there. And I love my in-laws, and they love me. And hopefully you will by the end of this talk. Because NJIT is the state's science and technology university, the only doctoral university in the state that's devoted specifically to the studies of science and engineering. And we truly mean that to be a service to the state. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the things first that we see from that vantage point and some of the things that we're trying to do first proactively where we can control the environment somewhat in Newark, but hopefully things that we have influence to have pervade throughout the rest of the state. Bob Franks gave you some compelling statistics about the impact and importance of the healthcare industry in New Jersey. And to a certain extent, since that was my role in the presentation, I'm done and I'm ready to take questions. But I have some other slides that I think make very similar points. The red bar, and that's really, even if you can't read the words, what's most important, the red bar is the employment in the life sciences industry. The headings above it are business services, financial services, distribution services, hospitality, and tourism. Is there a trend here? The state has very actively been focused on developing the service sector of the economy, and they've won an amazing victory. But in the process, we've perhaps lost touch with the production sector that's been so important to the health and vitality of the state and its economy. The life sciences perhaps remain one of the last vestiges of that. And it's not just the direct employment in the classic life science industries. Bob's group has done a study that demonstrates the considerable leveraging. He talked about the vitality of the sector leading to expanded facilities, and that pays off, of course, in construction jobs, the importance of supply chain, and put a bookmark there. I'm going to come back to this as something very important later on, and other triggers through the economy that there's a tremendous ripple effect so that the direct employment, in fact, is equally matched by the indirect employment. And Bob may remember statistics from our different era when we were promoting and advancing manufacturing, sorry to say, 15 years ago, that as the National Institute of Science and Standards and Technology was developing a nationwide program to assist small to mid-sized manufacturers, they demonstrated that there was a 4-to-1 leveraging effect between the manufacturing sector OEMs and its ripple through its supply chain and associated component parts, whereas the service sector was really a 1-to-1 leveraging. And so that's an important issue to remember as we talk about how do we make the whole state get well and take advantage of the tremendous presence of the anchor tenants that we have here as the global OEMs in the pharmaceutical industry. And here's more testimony. We can look at not only the direct dollars from the Hinge members, but some of the ripple through in terms of payroll, vendor spending, another $22 billion against a state GSP in 2004 of $374 billion from the private sector. Not a bad chunk, and perhaps undercounts with respect to the total impact when we do all the addition of some of the other components. So this really could be the end of the presentation because it all appears to be, in fact, wonderful and healthy. A high profile and productive research and development sector, tremendous payroll impact, the ripple through of construction, jobs, and the indirect benefits of charitable contributions and being good citizens in the community. That's quite a tremendous story in and of itself and really could be the end point of today's discussion. If all were well and rosy to the future, and not to wring the crying towel too profoundly here, but clearly you've already heard in the governor's comments the suggestion that there are potential changes that don't bode well for this industry and for others. I think we're all increasingly aware of the fact of the difficulty in bringing new products to market and the cost associated with it. For a variety of reasons, there's just no question that each new discovery takes greater and greater increments of investment that then have to be recovered against the prices that we pay for healthcare. There's global competition and, more importantly, global consolidation. And as a result, the chance that some of our anchor tenants go to somebody else's mall. And the area that's probably most dear to my heart, because it's an area where as a technology university we can both contribute and hopefully paint the picture for the future a little more clearly, there's the prospect of what one might call disruptive technologies. You have an industry that's a mature industry. It's really built itself up in the pharmaceutical side around what we call small molecule organic chemistry. And the future, not only for pharmaceuticals but for medical devices, may come through areas that they don't control captively within their own intellectual property. The advances in biotechnology, the advent of the kinds of machines that were once the fantasy of Hollywood, the Fantastic Voyage, micro and even nanoscale technology that allow for mobile, implantable, remote controllable devices for prosthetics, for drug delivery, information systems that essentially can make the difference between inpatient and outpatient care almost indiscernible. All of these are things which probably will be significant and important contributors to a future definition that at some point merges the concept of a drug and a drug delivery system, all of which happen outside the envelope in today's competitive concept of core competencies, outside the core competency envelope of the pharmaceutical industry. So if we look back, not that distant in time, I asked my kids 20 years and it might as well be 200 years, but even as I was a practicing young professor, we looked around New Jersey and saw that we were the center for virtually anything you might identify with high tech and with so many things that were bread and butter of our economy. Telecommunications, we were it. I mean, AT&T and RCA together owned the broadcast space and the landline space. Petrochemicals, we had Exxon with refineries, Florham Park research and development facilities, Mobil with a refinery down here in Paulsboro, research and development in Edison, New Jersey, Union Carbide in Bound Brook, City Service Research down here on the Turnpike, Celanese in Summit. The automotive industry had multiple assembly plants, and there was an industry that was already well practiced in the concept of supply chains. So not only did you have the assembly plants, but you had all the way down to the mom and pop shops making springs and washers that went into brake assemblies that went into those vehicles. Metalworking machinery, durable goods, refrigerators, Singer Kierfot, Frigidaire, defense electronics as a mainstay. And now we look back, and really in the blink of an eye, and certainly within a generation, if you will, of practicing professionals, we're really down to one sole survivor, an anchor tenant. And so that explains, I hope, to some extent, the realization that we can't let this one go the way of the others, and we have to look not only at those challenges as potential problems but and rationale for further diminution, but in fact as marching orders to figure out what are we going to do to create the kind of foundation that will keep what we have, will grow what we have, and will attract others. So here we sit, and I don't see a Mason-Dixon line. What New Jersey has been focused on through a series of efforts that I guess certainly date back to the aughts, 2000, 2001, is to develop the idea of regional hubs of economic development. To a certain extent, that's a bit of a silly notion for a state this small. If you were to wrap around with the New Brunswick to Newark distance to Camden distance, you essentially have the same distance as Research Triangle Park as a single hub in North Carolina, some of the distances in Silicon Valley. So really, as a state, we are a core, but we still haven't quite resolved that borderline issue. So we look at what might we do to have sub-hubs in the state. And this idea of economic development clusters based on initially the urban centers, but hopefully with those rings spreading out to encompass the entire state. And obviously already by the presence of the triangles of industries that are out there, you have a well-defined corridor that goes from New York City to Philadelphia, become the bedrock for the health of what we have and the growth of what we hope to have in the future. To a certain extent, they're a consolation prize. After the collapse of talks to consolidate the universities, which purported to help the pharmaceutical industry, the intent was, what can we do to take advantage of the fact that very clearly in Newark, New Brunswick, and Camden, we do have the strong presence of Rutgers, NJIT, UMD, private schools, all potentially to coalesce, not necessarily to recreate the Silicon Valley dream, because that's largely myth. Stanford didn't invent Silicon Valley. There are many other things that it helped to precipitate. Research Triangle Park wasn't created by the universities. It was the business interests that got together. The presence of the universities are an important contributing factor. But we don't have to become some imaginary valley of the future. There are, in fact, wonderful technologies and roots in our commercial base here to reestablish the position that we once enjoyed. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing in Newark, why I'm involved. We're a little bit ahead, I think, in the curve of this because we've been talking about the concept of developing a science park and a technology-based economic driver for more than a decade that I've been there. There's University Heights Science Park, about 40 acres between the northern boundary of NJIT and UMD, but adjacent to Essex Community College and Rutgers Newark. So we've been trying to build this dream for some time, and now we finally have some attention and perhaps some fuel to take it from an academic dream to something in practice. Many of you may know that there was a major study done on the life sciences supercluster by Professor Michael Porter from Harvard, also conducted in the same context of examining the potential for restructuring the universities. And there was an important concept that he's introduced into the lexicon here in the state, which is that of a cluster as opposed to a sector. Those statistics before about employment talked about a pharmaceutical or life sciences industry sector. That really goes back to SIC codes, or now NAICS codes, that designate what do you make, and largely looks at it from the standpoint of developing a product to a consumer. But it doesn't necessarily understand the concept of a supply chain. What about all the people who make the things that are then sold to other people who make the things that then sell things to the terminal OEM? Once upon a time, that was very often captive within the terminal OEM. AT&T made its own wires, invented those little snap modular plugs to connect those wires to your phones as well as to the cabling outside. They invented ABS as a break-resistant, impact-resistant plastic, so when you drop the telephone, they actually last 50 years, the old-style telephones, all to sell you long-distance services. I mean, that was the extent of vertical integration, and they actually not only did it, but invested tremendous research and development resources to keep improving the breed. So they knew as much about wire and cable coding as wire and cable coders. Those days are gone. And so the concept here is, how does one have the same sort of power of innovation that comes from understanding and controlling all of the elements from raw materials at the base level to your final product when you no longer have it all under your control? And that really is the concept of a cluster, that you create a dynamic network of companies that all work with each other and serve a variety of terminal OEMs, and that here's where co-location becomes powerful. So rather than thinking of the globe as flat, and therefore we source from all over the globe, there still is tremendous power and benefit at looking at these subsectors and elements of supply and having them co-located. And so herein lies the beautiful potential story for New Jersey, which is to build on the presence of the corporate headquarters, the research and development laboratories, and the other facilities associated with pharma to bring the whole shoot and match here in New Jersey. Because in fact, pharmaceuticals in production need chemicals and other raw materials. They need to be packaged, and packagers need extrusion equipment, injection molding machine, thermoforming machines. So there is fingerprints all the way down to the machine tool trade once a heart bedrock of New Jersey. Advanced instrumentation, electronics, and even information technologies that we look into the future all become important elements, either as elements embedded in the end product or as enablers for productivity in the process. So in Newark, Porter's group was then engaged to do a specialized study and take a look at the existing employment base in the city and in the immediate area and make some suggestions about areas of focus. And that's now been adopted by a group called Opportunity Newark. And those findings have been embedded then in the state's Innovation Zone activity and advisory board, which I have the privilege to serve on up in Newark. Now, it's not immediately obvious where pharmaceutical, medical device, healthcare plays in all of this. Local healthcare services is certainly one focus. I'll have a slide at the end that talks a little bit about the potential role and contribution of transportation and logistics. But it's also embedded in this education and knowledge creation sector. Now, it's almost there by accident. The reason that shows as one of the principal areas of focus is because Porter's group looks at employment. They look at where do you have a high density of employment, where do you potentially hire more people than the national average, and where are you growing faster than the national average. So guess what? Newark, believe it or not, is a college town. We have about 40,000 students and thousands of faculty and staff to support that. But that's not going to be a driving element in the economy. And so we sort of inverted that discussion to talk about how can the universities best contribute to rebuilding and reshaping the economy, not just out of our own self-interest, but out of essentially having the kind of state that we want to live in and having connections with the sort of companies that will employ our students in the future. And so the focus has been to develop a variety of initiatives piloted in Newark, but also in other places in the state that look at some of the places where we really can make a contribution to the industrial equation. And one of those things that's missing, and it really is subject for talk for another day, is to replace our lost capacity for advanced product research and development. It was the hallmark of the American economy, not just the New Jersey economy. And I mentioned some of the important contributors from New Jersey's past. Bell Laboratories, once able to not only solve all the problems that I talked about a few slides back, but have the time, energy, and intellect to look at what that noise was on the transmission lines between the satellite, which led rise to the Nobel for discovery of the Big Bang Theory. Exxon Research and Engineering, formerly in Florham Park, many of the others that were the examples of what globally dominant companies could sustain and support, an environment in which you had the world's leading professionals, best equipped, with their feet on the ground and their head in the clouds. They were exposed to the daily issues and concerns of the operating divisions, but they weren't slaved to getting the product out the next door the next day or firefighting and fixing up what was ongoing. They had the ability and the freedom to look over the horizon to the next generation of solutions. We've lost that capacity over the last 10 to 15 years through a variety of pressures of restructuring, and other countries, having not had the benefit of such industries, have found ways to create public-private partnerships that solve issues for sectors as opposed to individual companies. And so some of the things that we're doing in that spirit, you've all heard about New Jersey Stem Cell Initiative. It's largely been focused on a basic research and development story out of a partnership from Rutgers, New Brunswick, and Robert Wood Johnson. Very quietly up in Newark, we've developed a story that we think really focuses on the heart of how do we get science put into practice. And so rather than proposing a facility and a program that looks at academic scientific research, we're creating a pilot-scale biotechnology facility. There are already tremendous accomplishments that have been proven in clinical practice in use of adult stem cell therapies. But how does it go from the petri dish to mass production? Oil doesn't jump out of the well and go directly to your car. There's an entire industry spliced in between there that understands how to take the raw material and turn it into a deliverable product. We need the same sort of energy and focus on the production technologies that are associated with biotechnology. And here, where the burden of developing these is largely on small and mid-size emerging companies that don't have access to capital, to each recreate such a facility, we think we do a tremendous service to the sector and to the state by creating an environment in which we only not only build the next generation production technologies, but use that as a service to help those companies mature and grow. And so there is, if it will, a concept of the various process steps and operations being associated with each floor in this facility, where not only do we do it, but we build or invent what's going to go on in the core facility and continue to do the improvement. Nanotechnology, everyone and no one is a nano these days. It is one of those interesting fields where, in fact, virtually every scientific profession can claim not only is it their purview, but that they've been doing it for the last 30 or 40 years. What's important now is that there is enough scientific discovery that one can really start to seriously talk about making things at molecular levels and molecular dimensions. We have a group of faculty members, just to blow our own horn, who work in the area of what are called single-walled carbon nanotubes, which are shown schematically there. Wow, interesting. We can make a pipe out of carbon. Wonderful. Well, it is very interesting because they are able to, from that, creating them reproducibly and at specific lengths, create miniature solar cells, create a fuel cell that can be embedded in the body, metabolize the sugars in the bloodstream, and use that as an energy source, much as our muscles do. So now you have a renewable power supply that can, in fact, make that fantastic voyage become a reality. They are micro or nanoscale catheters or syringes. There are a variety of things that one can do as you can start to now create and control and fabricate things artificially at a molecular level with the same sort of precision that Mother Nature did in raw materials. There is a discussion now to focus on developing three or fewer or more, as the budget might allow, user facilities on nanotechnology. What do I mean by user facilities? The same concept I just described. Pilot scale facilities where those who now wish to engage in the production of nanoscale technology have a shared manufacturing space in which they can mature, build, grow those concepts into practice. We're in an era where the spirit of the garage inventor may persist, but the ability to do these sorts of things will never again happen in a small garage in California, whether it's the HP story or another generation later, the Apple story. We're now talking about millions of dollars of equipment investment to be able to see and manipulate things at that scale. And we need to provide some way to help not just the lone spirit who has a wonderful idea, but actually maturing companies that will never be able to afford that kind of investment replicated across all the possible contenders. I said I'd talk about transportation briefly. At NJIT, we've become the lead in developing a concept called the Liberty Corridor, an idea that has been in the making for some time. You probably know that the channels to Port Bayonne, Elizabeth, and Newark are now being dredged to make us the singular deep water port serving the entire East Coast, which in fact means serving at least through the middle of the country, and in some cases, we're already delivering products as far over as to the West Coast for European imports. Now, that could just make us require another few lanes on the Turnpike or on 78 or 80 to take all of the goods over to Pennsylvania or down to Delaware or somewhere else for customization handling, but the drive behind this, really, again, is to recreate or replace lost jobs in the manufacturing sector throughout the state. Well, how do we do that when sometimes we can't get to work, you know, in twice the time we ought to be able to allot for the miles that we're traveling? And so the concept here really is to think through, develop, and plan not just new bridges and new roadways, but an entire interconnected intermodal transportation system that allows things to come, be routed through for local customization of imports and hopefully in the future exports, get it through in, out, and around the regions and out to serve the rest of the country and market it to the world. It's a wonderful concept. It's not just empowering. It is fundamental if we're going to be able to survive doing those production sector activities that I described in the state and not take away all that green space that the governor referred to and that we want to preserve throughout the state. Well, us teachers have three R's. At least I grew up with three R's. I don't know the three R's these days exist. My daughter has stuff like DLA, It's something like distinguished language arts, I think. You know, an SRA is science and reading something or other as subjects. But some recommendations that we need to think of for the state. First, you've heard me bang the drum repeatedly, revitalize the production sector. If we can't call it manufacturing, if that appears too dirty, sorry, then we have to sneak it in, and sometimes just rebranding something gives it a new life. It is the production sector. It always was the production sector. It's not dirty. It's not being taken away by low-wage nations, or at least by low-wage labor. It's being taken away. Those countries have taken advantage of that status and developed highly automated and sophisticated production processes. And when you control that, as we've seen with the automotive industry, you largely then can control a great deal of product innovation. It can coexist in this state. It can coexist with our dense population base. There's enough ability to do this, and particularly to do it in the kind of high-tech products that we're all assembled here to pay homage to. We need to build that concept of a dynamic and flexible supply chain. Expand your operations, support your operations, do the things that are necessary to help you function as businesses, attract your trading partners and your supply chain partners, so in fact we can bring it all here to New Jersey. There are going to be issues with core infrastructure. We look at it just in Newark. It's not just transportation, parking, and mundane things like that. It's really creating the right physical environment to allow these companies to grow. And we have to find new models for collaborative research and development that really focuses on the product drivers. As a VP for R&D, I would love to take the state money. That's how I'm measured, not by taking the money, but by increasing our volume of research. But sooner or later, we got to produce. And I've been here for 36 years. I'd like to see my kids get through school and be able to afford to live in it. And so I think we as universities have to become real partners in figuring out how to contribute to solving those problems. And there are wonderful opportunities ahead of us. Well, so there we go. I hope, if I haven't earned my way into the family, you'll at least consider me as an in-law in South Jersey. I look forward to any questions you might have now, and any questions that we might take through the balance of the proceedings afterwards. Thank you.
Well, that was fast. Do you have time for we have time for a few questions, because I'd like to ask one myself.
No.
One of your slides, you showed the major industries in New Jersey 20 years ago and what's left. What happened to those other industries?
It's a combination of success. For example, Exxon is certainly a successful company, and success then breeds mobility. One of the researchers that I'm a fan of comes from MIT, Richard Lester, and he's developed this idea of hollowing out, that when a company becomes successful and global, after a while, if it depends less and less on local resources, its roots become weaker and weaker, and it begins to find itself mobile. Bad pun. In this case, Exxon found mobile and found itself mobile, and went to what it believed to be greener pastures, perhaps more affordable, perhaps better living conditions. Who knows? We don't know the inside story, but they certainly are gone, and with them went several thousand jobs. My premise is that what happened is, over the years, their production capacity disappeared from here. When I was a young graduate of Stevens looking for employment, I ended up with about five interviews with Exxon and never more than a car's drive. You know, I was trying hard to get a flight to the West Coast because I'd never seen it. And I ended up doing the tour of the refineries here in New Jersey. So you had Exxon Chemical and Exxon Chemical Research in Linden. You had the refinery and the refinery operations in Linden. You had Florham Park, Exxon Research and Engineering. You had Exxon Chemical Research also out there. As they moved operations first in the chemical side down to the Houston, and then increasingly put their emphasis on the Gulf Coast refineries and ultimately sold off the facility here, I think that whether it is explicit or not, that lack of connection between the R&D and corporate side and the production side of the business made it easy not to stay when there are other reasons to go. You also have, in a different context, then the impact of regulation on the AT&T system, the breakup, which then sliced it into smaller companies, none of which could support the kind of high-paced innovation that was necessary to keep them alive. And that's an example that I think really points to the need for some approach to consolidate resources to serve a sector if we want to preserve it here in the United States, because as we see now, Lucent could not afford, as the research arm of what was largely a supplier of equipment to cell phone towers, to have anything close to what it possessed in its heyday when it really was the telecommunications enterprise for the country and maybe for the world.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
We hope you enjoyed this first installment of South Jersey PharmaPod, the official podcast of the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance. We'd like to thank Don and Joyce Seco, the executive directors of the Alliance, for their assistance in the production of these programs. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to learn more about how to incorporate podcast programming in your business communications plans, please email me. The email address is steve@lubetkin.net. That's LUBETKIN.NET. For more information on the Alliance, please visit www.sjpmtia.org. For more information on our podcasting and other communication services, please visit www.lubetkin.net. In our next episode, we'll present a panel discussion on effective government relations programs featuring some of the senior lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry, and then we'll have my presentation to the conference on blogging and podcasting. Our third podcast in the series will present the afternoon panel of state legislators talking about issues that are key for the pharmaceutical industry in New Jersey. Be sure to join us for those other programs. We produce these programs in our studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For the South Jersey Pharmaceutical and Medical Technology Industry Alliance, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.